Bonjour, bonsoir, dear friends. Welcome, bienvenue on JCB Live. This is a wonderful happy hour. We are in the heart of Napa Valley, of course, in a secret place. You'll have to come to discover it. And I'm with two unbelievable, incredible, talented, powerful, ingenious intellectuals. They are partners in life as much as they are in business. They met at the famous college named Harvard. We've all had heard of it. And they became one of the most amazing, trend-setting, and really visionary architects of landscape in the United States and beyond. They work all around the world, and I got the pleasure to meet them on one of our key, most important project of all time, the oldest winery in California, Buena Vista. We became friends, and since then, we are inseparables to the point that we chose today this beautiful leopard room, as we are a dot apart from one another. And this is why, dear friends, today you get the chance to meet Roderick and James. Voila! Welcome, dear friends. Thank you.
It's the best. It's so nice to be amongst the animals.
Isn't it? Well, you love nature.
Yes, we do love nature.
So how did it start for both of you, the love of nature in your life in general?
Thank you.
Were you a baby? Were you a little child? An adolescent? It became, at Harvard, you said, nature is my thing.
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I think I've always been in nature. From an early age, my family comes from New Zealand. And so we would be surrounded by the bush and doing bush walks and tramps all the time with my grandparents. And we would be completely surrounded in the most beautiful landscape that I could think of. But growing up in Los Angeles, in Palos Verdes, we grew up when there were no houses there, so it was nothing but fields. And what was so amazing, I think, was catching the frogs and the lizards and learning about the plants, but even the construction sites, because all the houses started getting built, and all of a sudden there was other things to play with wood and giant sand piles and everything. So in some ways, that connection between nature and built environment has always sort of been there.
Yeah, so since you were a child.
Oh, absolutely.
It's in your DNA. So,
yeah, cheers.
We got a toast to DNA. And Roderick, you don't have to answer if you don't want to. But
no,
what
I
about
want to
you?
Answer. I think I
because
have,
you were sixth generation Napa Valley Californian.
I have two answers to that question. The first answer is that I grew up coming to Napa, visiting my grandparents from San Francisco. And I remember distinctly the kind of sort of wild nature that seemed so different than San Francisco to me, and the kind of magic that that created in my imagination. But I have a different answer for how I became a landscape architect in some ways, which is that I, as an undergraduate, I studied music. I have a degree in music, which is another passion of mine. And I was taking a class on opera at a certain point, and the professor talked about an opera called Bomarzo, which is an amazing Italian Renaissance garden.
Can we hear it today? Or
the opera was written by Ginastera, who's an Argentinian 20th century composer. And the opera uses all these kind of 20th century extended techniques to describe the state of mind of the mad count that, you know, created this garden.
That's right.
And I had never really considered that a garden could have this kind of narrative that Bomarzo had, even though it's a kind of fractured narrative. And so at that moment, I thought, I was so taken aback by the possibility that a garden, that nature, might be able to be constructed and kind of tell a story. And it kind of sparked some kind of interest and forward motion towards the work that we do, actually.
That's amazing. So as you create, the both of you, you created this amazing firm, and we'll come back to it, Surface Sure. Design. Do you think of the narrative even before you start creating a design? Do you have a dialogue in your mind and in your head?
Well, you know, we work differently, although it overlaps, of course. And so I think James starts with how he works.
Well, I think, well, if anything, I dream. Mm-hmm. I'm a dreamer, and I listen to everything. I visit a site. I listen to the people, the culture, the place, the plants, the animals, everything in it, and the art. And I sit there and I dream, and I try and fuse all these kinds of different experiences and cultures and places and placemaking all together, and then all of a sudden something comes out. And at half the time, I'm just trying to make sure that I remember it and remember it and remember it, which by the time I wake up and get to the office, when we used to be able to get to the office, that I'd have that ready.
And so the dream, it starts with a dream.
Starts with a dream.
But literally with a dream. Sometimes in the morning, James has a kind of an idea about a project after kind of, I think it's like a sort of digestion.
Yeah.
And there's something very intuitive about it, obviously. Yeah. And I think, in fairness, I'm less intuitive and a little more apply a kind of intellectual criteria to the mm-hmm. work that we do. Although I think I can be also that way, of course. But so I actually think those two sort of approaches, well, I would say this, but I think they're complementary. I think two dreamers at the same time sometimes creates a bit of chaos. So maybe we both can respond to each other's sort of
impulses. Oh, yeah, I think it's impulses. A feeding off of everything. Yeah. I think what we also love to do is to travel and visit galleries and to understand other allied fields.
But as you create and design, do you think about what the people are going to feel, are going to see, are going to sense? What goes in order of the alchemy of the senses to you? Because you mentioned music, which is a very interesting guidance into the garden. And that garden is actually conceived, playing on both, that binomial relationship between signs and sea. How do you do that, and how do you bring that in?
I mean, it is fundamentally a spatial exercise, right? So James also has a background in architecture. So fundamentally, when we arrive at a site, we are thinking about the spatial opportunities there. What can we draw from the site and exaggerate that? I mean, I think that when we worked with you on Buena Vista, I mean, we spent so much time there before anything was built or changed. Right. And so much of it is about trying to understand what can we draw out of here, and then maybe what can we insert here that might be unexpected, that no one knew was there, you know, to heighten your experience there. And Buena Vista is kind of interesting because in that small sort of corridor of it's actually quite different from the one building to the other. That's and right. It's kind of forested in areas and quite open in others, and there are views.
But I think when you went there initially, before any of the transformation happened, it was really like this sort of very tired site. And then what I call the death by asphalt approach of just running asphalt wherever the fire truck needed it to go, and neglecting the buildings and overgrown. So it really takes a lot of sort of freeing your mind.
Yes.
And trying to understand, like, how else could this be? And how else can you sort of integrate some of these sort of functional relationships that you have with a more poetic or material kind of approach? I mean, there's things at Buena Vista, like incredible... I mean, the site now is completely accessible to everybody, where it wasn't previously. It wasn't done in a dumb way. It was done in a way where the tactile quality of a cobble could reference and delineate where, say, fruits were going, but it connected to the larger poetry of the stone, of the buildings.
But I mean, a garden, a garden or a landscape is a completely sensual experience, right?
So your intellectual process, Roderick, is you want to tell a story.
Yes.
Right? So you arrive in a site, because I think it's so interesting for a lot of our friends with us today, is how do you approach, before even you get into the trees and the flowers, the dialogue between the emotion, the feelings, and the storytelling within the sites and the people. So how do you do this? Because I'm very merited about how you do it. is you start with the story.
Yeah.
Right?
I think we start with a story. I think we try to draw from our internal library of experiences we've had throughout the world that are amazing. We try to think about the Amalfi Coast or maybe Bakersfield. I mean, it doesn't have to be only the Amalfi Coast. It can be...
Or Paris, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and we have things that we... I know that we share...
And we refer to.
But it doesn't have to be. It can be some moment off the side of a road that's really made an imprint on us and us studying that. So there's the site itself and us spending time there trying to understand even sort of basic things. Where is the wind coming from and the light what can really thrive here? What's already here? Yeah. And then there's kind of this catalog in ourselves of references of how did they do that? Villa Cimbrione, or how did they do it? Us studying that, and is there a way we can maybe make sure we don't miss that opportunity?
Yeah, but I also think it's about trying to understand how do you pique people's curiosity?
Yes. Mm.
Because so much of our world has been homogenized and laid dumb for people. Not in a quote, effort to be safe. And I think that we lose that sort of intellectual curiosity or physical curiosity of what am I looking at? What is that? Is that's different? That challenge is what we like to put out to people, that you don't have to do it the regular way. You can do it in an interesting way, and that way can be interpreted in very different ways and on multiple levels. And so when that happens, like some of the stuff even in New Zealand that we've been doing, people look at that and say, what is that? And they start coming up with their own stories. Oh, that's a dunescape. Or, oh, that's Mordor. Or, like, whatever. It doesn't matter. The matter that the discussion and the ideas are fostering conversation and stimulating your brain.
But in terms
of the catalyst of generating within someone a thought process.
Exactly. But, I mean, in terms of process specifically, then it becomes iterative. I think I bring from music, which is you keep practicing, you chip away at something. You don't just arrive there. You actually need to do 5 versions and then 3 and then 4 and then 2 and then we show you something like that. It's a very, I mean, maybe it's like making wine. I don't make wine.
Well, music has a lot of energy.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of vibration music as well. How much in your thinking, as we're drinking bubbles, and this is our
delicious,
favorite JCB21, we've had so many times together, explain how you punctuate the sense of vibration and feelings and emotion within a design. Whether it's Buena Vista that you've done, and we'll see in a moment your fabulous book, how do you approach the idea of energy? Because I think our friends would be fascinated. I was fortunate to get to know you many years ago and to realize you understood energy and you understood magnetic energy, you understood quartz analysis.
Yeah.
So tell us about that and how important it is for people to take that into account.
Oh, I think it's really important. I think there's so many things in this world that we don't quite understand or they're not visual to us. And you can feel when you're in those zones. It's when I guess Roger's thinking intuitive or the way you step into something, you can feel that energy, that there's a blockage or that this, we want to go that way, you know.
That's right.
Let's do this. And it is until you start to, understand some of the larger principles that are forces that are at place.
That people drove you to go that way.
Yeah, exactly. And there's layering in that sort of energy of placemaking that you have to tap into.
Yes.
And that's the really important portion of this. And to maybe describe on such a different level than you could sort of rationally talk about something. It's that line between.
But there is sort of a pragmatism to it as well, as that's very basic, at least in terms of what we do. And I think to an extent what you do is the soil itself is
yes,
the foundation
the soil,
for
the
that energy. And obviously someone like Rudolf Steiner and biodynamics is considering all of that, unlocking that energy and creating some kind of dynamic there.
Yeah,
and that is the basis for what we do. I mean, increasingly...
I'm going to give you by hand.
Yes.
As you bring Rudolf Steiner, we have to bring the Deloge
yes.
wine now.
Yeah. And you're...
But keep going, because
two-fisting.
Two-fisting.
Right.
We God gave us two hands.
Yes,
that's right.
We got to use them
all
the
time
for whatever it is. But I want to raise my glass to this.
Yes.
So continue, Roderick, on that path, because I really feel people need to reflect, stand still, and feel and sense and take their time.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
To enjoy the time that time wants to give them.
Yes.
Yes.
And within that spectrum of time, that journey,
yeah.
identify what they feel and what they want to do with what they feel.
Yes.
It could be their garden, the terrace.
Yeah.
It could be trees. It could be flowers. It could be a parterre. It
yes.
could be anything.
Yeah. Yeah. I think also, though, what we do, I'm increasingly realizing, is we actually are giving people an opportunity to spend time with something that's a little more ephemeral and delicate than you know what we
yes.
see
yeah.
every day. And I know that that's frustrating sometimes, because flowers go away
You're
or
right.
plants need maintenance and so forth. But
yes.
But actually, to me, that seems like a great contribution, is to have people be able to pause and have a moment of reflecting. And to me, that's energy.
That's
because,
right.
Yes.
Because so we've been in Napa. I mean, we're in San Francisco, but after, you know, in this last few months, we've been up in Napa, kind of sheltering in place, I guess. And so we've kind of seen really closely this seasonal change, even from March until July now. And because we're there and we're in our garden.
That evolution of the landscape is marvelous.
It's, you know, I mean, it was spring, now it's midsummer,
summer.
But we've kind of already evolved tremendously in our garden from what was there to what's now. And that, you know, most people don't have so much of a commitment to being in their garden for all that time. So often we're just providing them a day or a half a day with,
right.
you know, like at a place like Buena Vista, or maybe even in some of our public projects, like
yes.
at Land's End in San Francisco, you know, maybe it's a couple of hours, but it's an hour to kind of take yourself away from
that's right.
from that. And
yeah.
so I do think that's energy too. You're
for
seeing
sure.
spring come up, you're seeing summer kind of bring things into another place. So it's, you know, seasonal, obviously, too.
But I think you're also
yes.
feeding your brain at the
yes.
same time. Because I think there's this notion how we've been wrapped up in technology and all this kinds of stuff that, you know, we've forgotten nature. And in some ways, this a respite in the world that's gone on that allows us to reconnect to nature.
Yeah.
And nature almost reconnecting itself.
That's
and
right.
what's going on right now. And so it's fascinating, I think, to understand what, as Roger was saying, like these seasonal changes,
mm-hmm.
but they're very subtle.
Yeah.
And to be able to slow down and read the subtleties of a landscape and is rare. And it's informative, and it makes you, you know, pause and think about what's going on in your life.
And do you see, you know, I was raised, you know, eating the season,
yeah.
drinking
yes.
the season,
yeah.
right.
enjoying the colors of the season. I'm from obviously a world where the four seasons play a big role.
Yeah.
They're very accentuated by
yeah.
their color and
yeah.
root system. So you have beets at this time and you have lettuce at this time and tomatoes at that time
yeah.
and none another. How much do you think sociologically we back to evolving into understanding the seasons and understanding the time we live in? And do you feel in your work people are moving into that direction?
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think
yeah.
it's part of the, you know, the opportunity of what we do. That said, though, I feel like California in some ways has more three seasons
yes.
than four seasons. I also, just as a kind of another piece of sort of information about us. James is from New Zealand and from Southern California, and New Zealand has a kind of a different seasons, and we do work in places like Hawaii, which also have seasons, but it's a really different kind of engagement season. Yeah. And we're really lucky to be able to think about things like seasons in different places.
That's right.
Obviously.
Yeah. I mean, that's, and you know them all and you integrate them. So we'll come back to this vision of the future that we ought to create at some stage.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Let's go back to your beginnings. You meet at Harvard. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then how do you create a company in landscape, architecture, and design? Because I got to say, this is pretty impressive. Both of you meet, bang, you work a little bit for others.
Yep.
You're both professors at Harvard today, and you decide we're going to start a firm.
Yeah, I mean, so this is the thing that probably is a little bit...
True entrepreneurship.
Know, but the truth is we're... We just walk into things without a lot of incredible, you know, like study.
I love it.
We worked for other people. There was a moment that it felt like we actually kind of had a little garden that ended up being published. And it just felt like, well, we should probably stop working for, I mean, I'm being actually pretty sincere. It just kind of seemed like it wasn't brave or anything. Oh, it just seemed like...
Doing something on your own is very brave because it's not easy.
But there was, but we didn't think, we just kind of, it seemed like, oh, now is the time that we have to do this, really.
So you felt it was meant to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
that's right.
But I also thought we are very similar in other ways, and think about other things. But I also think it's part of a larger legacy of landscape architecture as a profession.
Yes.
Because, as Roderick mentioned, we work for other characters, and we're the next generation. And and so many times, at least within our profession, we've lost generations. You know, in the 80s and all the stuff that had happened. And so it's been a while before the next generation has been able to stand up.
You
and
felt
so
it was a calling.
Absolutely, it was a calling.
So you believe in fate.
I do. I think.
I just felt like it just happened.
It did just happen, but it didn't, it wasn't, because you're just so comfortable the direction and passion of what you're going to do, there's not, you don't almost don't have a choice in my mind.
Well,
you
want to do it. But I think you do believe in fate.
Oh, I do believe in fate.
And I'm not sure I believe in fate.
I know.
You believe in destiny, which could be a variance of fate?
I kind of just think, I believe in accidents and sort of...
So meeting James was an accident?
Kind of. I think so.
It was a pretty good accident.
Yeah. I don't take accidents in a
negative
way.
Or positive.
I just mean it just kind of happens. You know?
So how is it to run such a fabulous and very successful company as business partners and partners in life?
Yes, the 7/24/7 relationship. Yeah.
I'm gonna have a little drink. Pinot Noir is gonna help to this one. So how I'm always curious because...
Well, I have the same answer that I kind of answered, but James might have a more thoughtful one, which is that it just kind of... We were always kind of working and doing that together. It's not a drama at all. Actually, the truth is we hardly ever have a disagreement about maybe, let's say, the design part of it.
Right.
I mean, we don't always agree, but it's not an argument. It actually flows very... natural
discussion
in a pleasurable way, actually.
Yeah.
The arguments come about through the politics of stuff, you know, which is always the way it is. It's the trivial stuff. It's not the big. The
well,
big
you
things
do major
are there.
Projects. I mean, from you know the very large public endeavors, and you'll tell us about that in a moment.
Yeah.
What is it to you taking risk? How do you define in your life? Because I feel, which is so exciting, and I recommend for everybody to do the same.
Absolutely.
When we look at landscape together, you push me to take risk as well.
Yeah.
Yes.
In what I see, what I don't see, what I feel, what people will see in the future in that landscape, as well as in your life. Because you've lived, you know, you have a big firm of almost 50 people, and you do a lot of work all around the planet. And it's a big risk, too. So give us...
Sure, but part of the risk is part of the adventure.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's about making magic wherever you go. I mean, and there's magic in everything, and I think that's really important to have that sort of, nothing ventured, nothing gained is a stupid phrase, but it's sort of true.
Yeah.
And because every time you risk something, you put a little bit of ourselves out there for people to judge or whatever. It doesn't matter. But what we're doing is we're saying, hey, there's a different way of thinking about this.
That's right.
And it's important that we always continually challenge ourselves. We challenge the architects. We challenge the clients. We challenge everybody. And it's done not in a challenge to be challenged way. It's done in a way that will promote the project or whatever we're working on in a way that, people need to be pushed.
And are people willing to take risk?
Yeah. I think what's really important about risk-taking is that part of the narrative or part of the interface when Roderick and James come at you is really about a sense of camaraderie that you're in it together.
Yes.
That we're progressing and moving things forward on a much larger level than, let's just say, the project itself.
It's not risk for risk's sake.
No,
that's right.
I mean, so that's not interesting to me. It's not provocation just
that's right.
to get a reaction. It's actually pretty rooted in a sincere desire to kind of unlock this puzzle about
yes.
about
how do you
the
stay
site.
Current on that puzzle? Because you amaze me always. I come from the old world,
yeah.
and I know more about the old world than the new world. And if America is a new world,
yeah.
I venture to say it's an old world as well. You really refer to Egypt, to Greece, to Rome, to France, to all that world. How do you stay informed with everything that you do?
Well, I would say that when we one thing that is unites us is we are very curious people.
Yes.
The two of us are very curious. And when I first met James, that was sort of the way we connected, was we were always up for an adventure.
That's right.
And I remember we would, at the time when we first met, we'd kind of travel around. Actually, we were in Boston, but we'd go to New York a lot. And I remember taking James to things that I was interested in. For example, there's this house in Tribeca called the Dream House, which is this Lamont Young, this composer created this kind of 24-hour installation of sound and light. And I remember taking James there and I thought, gee, is this just too much? You know, I mean, is this like irritating? But then a week later, he's like, kind of refers to it, makes reference to it. And that was kind of a moment of, us sharing that curiosity. I think it's just curiosity. And I think that
that's fabulous, in a
lot of ways.
It's the biggest form of intelligence for me.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I think that we are realizing also that curiosity is actually impacting our design now. I think we're probably designing it a little different. I'm having this thought lately, and we've been talking I think 15 years ago, I would have approached things maybe slightly differently because I'm interested in different things. For example, I'm a little more interested in planting as a compositional element and color specifically. Even color theory is something that I'm very interested in.
Yes.
And I think I was...
Tell us about color theory, in fact.
Well, I feel like
that's
such
a fascinating world for people. Even individuals, if they have a 200-square-feet garden... Color theory is essential.
Well, so I think that I am such a student that I can't say that I, really
the
can represent it.
Professor, you say you're a student. I love it.
But I've
never seen him so humble.
No, yeah.
Well, that's because the camera is on. You
know? Yeah, that's right.
So,
what's going to happen?
And I'm the one
me?
From LA, right?
But I... I'm thinking about color theory in all kinds of ways. I mean, in terms of, modern art, in terms of the way that Hans Hofmann was looking about color theory as like a spatial element.
Spatial element.
And so I think about that in a garden quite often. I think about it in terms of the way that even Gertrude Jekyll would talk about it in her perennial plantings. Yeah. And she wrote about color theory quite
a bit.
I think kind of about it in terms of Steiner and his color theory, but it's so mystical that I'm not sure I understand it.
I think you do very much, because one of your big philosophies, the both of you and your overall team, and now many of your clients that I know and many I do know, is into organic and biodynamic, is into sustainability, water management.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And all that. So Are you really as well moving in this direction?
Yeah.
In terms of...
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think it's... When we... A lot of it has to do with scale. We have a very big project in Seattle right now that you and we've talked about.
Of course.
40 acres. That's and so when you're touching 40 acres, when you're, you know, there's big buildings on it. It's for Expedia, Inc., and then part of it's public. But... You're actually kind of creating an ecosystem that's pretty significant at the scale of 40 acres.
So yeah.
Much like, you know, a vineyard is of the scale that can really make an impact on habitat. So all, well, so you...
Well, no, but you're starting with the soil again.
Yeah.
You start from the base.
Yes.
And what I find interesting about sites like the one in Seattle, that these are completely artificial, man-made sites. So here you have a piece of the sound that people threw their rubbish in to create land so that they could build on it. And filled in, there's literally two piers that they buried in place. And so how do you create a whole landscape on stuff on something that is basically rubbish? So you start with the really intense analysis and understanding what the site is doing, and then literally cherry pick spots that are working, and then take them and apply them and grow the mycorrhizals, grow this kind of organic material, and inject them
into the soil before it's actually applied on site. And then there's a whole, that informs the kind of compost tea that is then applied throughout the maintenance of the site. Actually, I, you know, there are people that would say, is that really doing anything? But it's not even vague. The plants are thriving.
They're thriving like crazy.
Like crazy.
It's the insect are thriving.
Oh,
the insect,
the life,
including the bunnies.
Yeah.
That's but it. Everybody's doing...
So there's energy, for sure.
But the part of this stuff is that people... Again, it takes time.
Yes.
It takes time to grow in. It's like the compost tea and all the stuff we were talking about and fixing the soil. Actually, in long term... allows the plants to thrive, which means your maintenance is down.
Yeah.
So describing to someone on a maintenance crew that actually doing this hocus pocus stuff as they like to think about it, which is very hard to convince people to do, actually is in their long-term benefit.
That's
now there are projects out there that show it, just like some of your wineries and this delicious wine we're tasting.
Well, tell us
no,
about
but
it.
It's still, it's. I mean, this is the
Give
is really
us in
good.
Three words, whether coloring or... words, what you feel. Excuse me. The energy, the excitement makes me explode in all kinds of ways.
To me, this totally roots me in the earth. I'm feeling the sunlight on the leaves moving through the rootstock and then into that soil.
Ooh,
that's what I'm playing with this. Absolutely. Death.
So that's our Pinot Noir from Deloach. You know, the estates. Obviously, our wonderful Rudolf Steiner, you mentioned.
Yeah.
The whole philosophy is within what you sense, what you feel, and you feel it.
Absolutely.
So when you recently decided to document your fabulous work, you created a new book. I would love for you to share one of the parts of the book you love the most. And why did you do a book, and what drove you not only to write it, but to showcase all that great work?
So we worked with Monticelli Press out of New York. We worked with an editor named Elizabeth White, who is extremely seasoned sort of art and architecture and landscape architecture editor. We worked with friends out of New York called Binocular Design, who did the design of the book.
The finisher of it.
Yeah.
And I think that more than anything else, you know, it was a project to try to punctuate, not to create a tome, not to create the final word.
That's right.
But to just say, to collect, for us to actually digest what we've been doing for the last however long it was, I don't remember.
10 years.
10 years or something like that.
Yes.
Or a little bit longer. Because We're so busy in the doing of the projects, yeah. which is where we want to live. We love yes. that. That's
we're builders.
That's so great.
In that way, yeah.
And that's really what we set out to do.
And I see a lot on your road right here.
Yes, yeah. I know.
And so we love being in the projects and them becoming realized. But in a way, it was a great way for us to step back and kind of try to organize this information to try to
yes.
understand if it actually... To see if it was all connected, I think it is all connected, but I think there are moments when maybe it's not as connected.
Well, which I love is I see a common thread and common
yes.
style.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
So the book is Surface Design Material Landscapes, but I see as well a lot of diverse projects.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you succeed in many architects, in many designers, you see something and you say, oh, that yeah. is Roderick
yeah.
and James.
Yes, right. Yeah.
In many of those projects,
yeah.
you succeed into having such diversity. So
yeah.
explain us that, because as winemakers, mm-hmm. often we could be branded as one style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not always as easy
yeah.
to have a multiple style.
Yeah.
No, how do you yeah, succeed yeah. in that?
Well, I think it is that sort of a different... I think in our past, what I would call your signature architecture, like you...
Yes.
Or whatever. You clearly know who did it.
Yes.
And I think that becomes sort of restrictive because people will only hire you for that thing. And we honestly just don't even think that way. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't do it if we tried.
Yes.
To be honest about it. And I think that diversity and it really does. Like it comes from understanding the project, the client, and the culture.
Yes.
And pulling stories or creating landscapes that are from that place. So... if you design something that is here in San Francisco and you design something in Mexico, they're not going to look the same. And if they do look the same, there's something wrong.
That's right.
You know, and so
you take into account what we call in wine terroir.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's sense right. of place.
That's right.
Place, and yeah. adapt it.
But also, we're very, in some ways, self-serving. To us, it's every project is an adventure. And if it doesn't fit into that category...
That's right.
Then we probably can't contribute it to
it's got to be fun.
And so we... this is like just a catalog of these little...
I love it. And can you please advise to all our friends listening,
yeah.
whether they have 100 acres,
yes.
yeah.
1 acre,
yeah.
a tenth of an acre,
yes.
a little backyard, which is the size of our room,
yeah.
Yeah.
it's storytelling, it's a stage,
yeah.
and they should
yeah.
play with it.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So the advice is what?
Well, is
to be free.
Well, don't hold
to
back.
Be free.
Don't hold back.
Exactly.
But there's
isn't
no
it?
Reason.
Right.
There's absolutely no reason.
Yeah. I mean, I think you have to reconcile that you have things you might be drawn to, and you should yeah. just do it. I mean, and who cares what anyone else says, right? I mean,
yeah.
And there's a dialogue of looking outside and energy that is being told from the outside to the inside.
Yeah.
And that feng shui, that dynamics between both
yeah.
is essential. And you bring a lot of your outside inside of the house too.
Yeah, yeah we do. We do, exactly. And even yeah, the inside outside. I mean, even I get more drawn into some of the cultural aspect of some of these projects. The play, like the culture it's been.
Yeah.
How do people see? I mean, our stuff in Hawaii, always, and even New Zealand, dealing with the descendants of the native indigenous people is fascinating to
I
me
love
because it allows one to engage a different group of people that do not think like you. They don't think like Westerners. They don't think like Easterners. They think of in a different kind of way. And I love when you go to Honolulu, let's say, and it's not north, south, east, west. You know, it's Malka, Makai, Eva, Diamond Head. They're using landscape elements
to find
describe
where
they are. And that connection to a place, I
yes.
think, is inspiring. And then once you know more, like, what was this? Was this land? Was this a coral bed? What was this? And those kinds of inspirations and those stories that you hear, whether you're designing on a highway in New Zealand and you've learned that so many such and such battles had happened along here over the time, and that, you know, there's a specific tree species that you can plant to heal some of those wounds for a community that doesn't have a voice, then that's what we're excited about. Who are these moments that we can, you know, inspire beyond what
So the culture, the people, the tribe, eventually, the tribe where they come from. Yeah.
But I do think we are Californians, the two of us, and in some ways that's given us a little bit of freedom from tradition.
Yes.
And that's something I feel like you're kind of an honorary Californian in that way.
I know he's honorary.
Well, I'll toast to that.
You're welcome that way. Yes, absolutely.
And it's something we observed in our studies, in our graduate studies, you know, feeling like a place like the Graduate School of Design at Harvard is incredibly Eurocentric, which, of course, we're very interested in, but we also, I think we both felt like, but there's this other world too.
Yes.
And and that's really amazing that we need to kind of study and celebrate. And so, you know, our last studio we taught was last spring.
Yes, spring, yeah.
And we brought our students, so we teach a graduate studio sometimes there. And we brought these students in the middle of February to Joshua Tree.
Yes.
Talk about energy.
Energy.
And my favorite topic.
Yeah. Yes.
And so, you know, in the middle of winter to bring 13 people to the middle of the desert, this spectacular kind of otherworldly environment, although everyone sort of talks about how otherworldly, but it's just what it is. It's just not Boston. And they were blown away. One of the things that was tough, though, is that they almost didn't know, they didn't want to touch it. They recognized how delicate of an ecosystem that was.
I love
that. So it was tricky. Also, I'm going to answer your question somewhat retroactively about how you stay current. And that is through the people that we work with and the people that are our students. And listening to them and being surprised.
So
by
teaching
them
is very important too.
Teaching and having a youthful office that is, you know, I always like laugh like we're a band of misfits.
Yeah.
Because you look at our office and, you know, everybody's from some crazy wacky place or has had amazing sort of experiences.
Yes.
So it's that constant collision of people's and their backgrounds and where they're from that really inspire all of us. I mean, we might generate the idea, but they're taking it to the next level.
Or we might not generate the idea. I mean, you know, we might pull it out of someone. I don't know. I mean, we talk about this frontier and what's new, but in some ways we're a very old-fashioned design office.
Yes.
You know, we're trying to be collaborative. Yeah. I know we're collaborative with each other and with other people. And we are hoping that we'll be surprised by a solution, you know, as much from each other as from the people we work with.
Yeah.
So,
well said.
Yeah.
So on that note, what is the dream you haven't yet achieved that you wish to share? Is it to create a fabulous architectural landscape on Mars, on the moon, which is obviously my dream, is to go in space. I wanted to be an astronaut when I was five.
Yeah.
And still today, but...
Yeah.
I know you have a lot of dreams.
I have a lot of dreams, of course. I think I dream about how we can rethink cities.
Yeah.
Especially in the situations we're in now. The car wins every time. I think the car needs to lose. Bikes have fought hard to get a little bit of up there. But you know who's been left in the dust? Pedestrians.
That's right.
Yeah.
People, we've been left in the dust. And so,
what about recreating Paris sidewalks everywhere?
Well, absolutely.
Exactly.
No, but that's the scale and
the
size.
The outdoor. And
it's beautiful, right? You stroll. You engage. Now you get out on a sidewalk that's 5 feet wide, and you're going to get you're shoved between a parked car and
so
asphalt.
Rethinking cities is very important.
I think for me, it's very important. I think some of the solutions to some of the things that we
are you thinking your idealistic city at this stage?
Yeah, because
we have to
because we're no longer going to need cars.
Yes.
There'll be driverless cars. There might be, you know.
And I really don't know how downtowns will function.
That's right.
So what's the transformation of the city when we have these new...
Which is a very exciting.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
As you're a landscape architect. By the way, what is a landscape architect?
Oh, that's a good question.
Well, that's your title, so I'm sure the world wants to know. You create windows in the landscape?
Yeah. I think
the term landscape architect comes from Olmsted, who was the designer of Central Park in New York. Yeah. And so it was a progression of the sort of English landscape gardener designer into actually kind of an urban context.
And civil engineer at the same time.
Right.
Yeah. It was this idea that a lot of new infrastructure were going in.
Yeah.
And he was this enlightened soul. And he looked at what was going on and transformed not only just to create a park, but to make it a functioning element.
A function. I asked the question, obviously, because that's where you were going in your urbanization or reinvention of the city. And I'm delighted to hear that from you, because I know you're thinking of it in San Francisco and in L.A.
Yeah.
and many other great American cities. I've observed what has happened in Paris and London and obviously Lyon and Marseille and Bordeaux. And it's a lot of French examples purposely. It's a reinvention of the town.
Yeah.
And how we move, how we behave, how we interact, how we sit.
Yeah. yeah.
And how we observe nature.
Yeah. I think, you know, in my mind, Los Angeles is also a kind of fascinating opportunity to kind of rethink the city. And so I'm really curious about how that evolves.
Yes.
And so I guess in some ways that's one dream, is to participate in a positive way to something like that.
That's what a great dream.
Yeah.
And to reinvent the cities of tomorrow.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Why should the city of tomorrow be the same as the cities of today? When we look at the evolution of many European cities, even, they've been rethought.
Yeah.
I mean, there's always been influences on those cities on how they're developed. Whether it was someone in Chicago drawing up San Francisco and totally ignoring the topography.
That's right.
With the grids of the city. To, you know, Haussmann, right? Who, I got to get my army through here.
That's the dream.
So that's why we're doing these big gestures. You know, it's more of a geopolitical kind of
Do you feel
to Robert Moses?
To Robert Moses, exactly. Moses, I mean, Moses in New York. And these are big gestures that have major impacts, but good and bad.
Yeah.
And so, but that's fine. They did something. I mean, that's part of what we
really
think.
I don't know
really
if it's fine, but,
well,
but
I know,
think
but
it's,
it, it, it's
they
like,
acted
they
on,
acted
that.
On
that's
something
right.
that they thought was right at the time.
Right, but the inspiration might...
I will toast to that, because I think in life often I see people drawing and drawing and drawing and losing themselves in a drawing and never acting.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And to your point, Haussmann, Moses, and many of those actually, whether we agree with the grid, or even L'Enfant in D.C.
L'Enfant, exactly.
L'Enfant is a great example.
Well, I guess my point is that now we have maybe a different criteria than the, you know, we've shifted away from just pure development in Moses' case.
That's right.
To something that's probably a little more about sort of fixing some of these bigger environmental issues.
Well,
as opposed to...
Yeah. And it reminds me of this wine. Look, we're trying a Bordeaux style, the first Méritage leaf, found in the late 70s. What did he do? Five grape varieties put together to create the alchemy of the best. The sum is greater than the parts.
Yeah.
And I think of this often when I think of our discussion, and I want everybody to continue to hear it for the sake of the city of tomorrow. And how can nature further, because you're very respectful of nature, the one-to-one ratio or even more of nature, versus how can we plan more by using nature as a guidance of education? And I know you're doing a lot of key projects on that front.
Sure.
Didn't you do Golden Gate?
Yeah.
Bridge Plaza
and Land's End, and even a project right now, Bluxome, in downtown San Francisco, where there is literally, we're changing a street into a park.
Wow.
And what's fascinating about that is that there's a whole approach the city is, you know, is forward thinking and thinking about how do you get animals as well as people in a space.
Yes.
So we're developing things like pollinator pathways, where we're picking species and then running them right up the buildings, knowing that a certain bird and a certain bug is can only fly so high, but we're literally giving little leapfrogs and places for them to hang out on their way up. And that's one thing I also, I think that it is something that is monumental about landscape that does do is that it is more than architecture where there's, you want to keep the animals out.
Yes.
Landscape, you want to keep them in.
That's
and the
right.
richer and the more diverse that kind of population is, the healthier the landscape is.
Aren't they part of the landscape anyhow?
Yes.
Aren't they part of society?
Right.
Well, absolutely.
Without the bees, I don't think we would be
No, that's exactly. The wine or anything. No, it's true. And I think, you know, monumentally, I mean, one of the, maybe the highlights of my crazy life was at a sort of, I don't know, I wasn't even 30 at that point, and I was working on the Sydney Olympic Games, and I was given a tiny little frog that was about to go extinct.
Huh.
And I had to analyze that frog.
You
and
didn't
understand.
Cut her legs and put
no.
them in the
No.
Like
no,
the
no.
French would do and have
frogs. No, this is
frog's
a beautiful legs. Frog. He was gold and green, and it was like this sort of iconic, which is Australia's color, so there's a whole, you know, into this frog, and it was in danger of dying, gone off this planet. And I figured out where they like to live, where they like to breathe, where they like to what sun themselves.
That's right.
And literally in the design, secretively mostly, and working with the ecologists, created these microenvironments for this frog. And I was told it's now been 20 years since that project happened. That frog is now off the endangered species list. So single-handedly,
that's right.
The landscape has been able to save entire species. In fact, they're multiplied so much, they're everywhere, which is great.
I actually think there's a whole body, a public body of people that are really ready to act in this direction. It's just a little bit of pushing to the bureaucracy of things, which, as you know, bureaucracy is not really our favorite place to live, and so sometimes
nature will always win.
Yeah, eventually.
So, is there something as we tried the Leith? This man in 1979.
Yeah,
we bought the winery. Did the impossible. He came from Aspen. He was the son of a banker, and he said, "I'm moving west. I'm a hippie." I have a Harley Davidson. I'm going to buy vineyards and make wine like the French.
I'm hanging out with this guy.
Well, totally. And we are now because we continue his dream and he created a great wine. We'll try then one of the American classic, Raymond. But before we go to Raymond, is there a dream you have that you haven't yet accomplished or something that you see in your dreams or something, you know, I think of the Babylonian Garden.
Yeah.
I think of the Impossible Labyrinth.
Yeah.
I think of the suspended society. I think of creating a garden in the desert. So I have a ton, as you know, we know each other well.
Yeah.
Wild and crazy ideas from the past and the future.
That's the way it's got to be.
What about yours?
I do think that I have a dream about the desert and about a kind of an amazing desert garden that speaks to the ecology of the desert, but is... also celebrates the completely otherworldly character of that space that feels endless. Actually, last time we were there with our students, I was talking with one of the students and got distracted and got lost in the desert. And I don't know if you've ever gotten lost.
Did you go behind a cactus? Or was it behind a snake? Or how did you lose?
You just walk, and if you take the wrong turn, you're in the middle of the desert. And
by yourself?
Well, I was with a student, actually, and it took us about two...
Was it intentional, maybe?
No, it was not.
He's trying to tell us a story.
No.
But within about an hour, you're panicked. You're completely in the desert.
I believe it.
You're completely kind of... And you feel really, really tiny. And you know, because, of course, you walk around as kind of very cinematic, but you walk and then all of a sudden you see these footsteps that you already were just there.
And you're lucky that they're still there because... If you're in Northern Africa's desert, the wind takes it off.
Yes.
You're gone.
And it happened to me on a camel once in a while. I wanted to showcase to the friends I was with that I was better than they are, which obviously I was worse than they are. And I galloped on a camel, get behind a dune, had to go around the dune. Suddenly I saw no one.
Yeah.
And I didn't know on which side of the dune I was.
That's
the wind had come. could not see the mark. You know what I did? Let the rein off, and I said to the camel, go.
Go.
And he took me back.
Yeah. Wow.
Unbelievable. I would have been
probably
a nice skeleton eaten by the vultures.
Well, you know, there's in the desert, there's a couple categories of missing people. There's missing people that they think have just gone, but they're still around. Okay. And then there's people that they think are presumed dead.
I think I need another glass of wine. So now, for the last few minutes, you haven't mentioned the dream.
No, no.
James, what is it? Is it the desert? Is it another planet?
Well, the desert is always a draw. I mean, that's why that class we taught, Super Bloom, was so inspirational, I think, not only for us, but for our students, because
thank you.
The way global warming is going, our environments are changing more and more like those kinds of conditions. So how do you survive in that? But when it comes to dreams, I think for me, it's always going to be the coast.
Yes.
Oh. This notion of how we engage with water's edge.
Oh.
And I think it's that becomes really important, because not only in global warming, we're getting sea level rise.
Yes.
What does that mean? And how do we rethink engagement with the water? Whether that's a floating landscape.
Yes.
Or like something like Xochimilco,
great example.
In Mexico City. And, you know, there's all these different ways of engaging the edge. I'm always at the edge. There was this one moment that always has stuck in my brain. I had this very modernist architecture professor once, but he's from Romania. And I think the most potent thing that he told me once was, you know, the most interesting spot when you go to the beach is that interface between where the water comes in and out, in and out. And that's where the people sit. That's where people always want to be on the edge. They don't want to be in the center. They want to be on the edge, and the edge is dynamic.
Interesting observation.
So you're always sort of moving. And to me, that connection to a landscape, even though I was an architecture student at the time, has always sort of influenced me on how people engage with that interface.
And you use a word earlier, James, named magic. Mm-hmm. And I love that word. Of course, we were together with our great friend Jay Alexander, a fabulous magician.
Spent
the night of our life. And he's fantastic.
The Red Room, that was awesome. Yes.
So where do you see the world magic in your world? Because I obviously see it, but I'd love everybody to open to this as well.
Magic. That's a
what is magic to you, and how do you create magic in a garden, landscape, or in a sense of place?
Well, I think magic in a garden is when you really are. It's a completely engrossing experience, and you lose track of time.
Yeah, time.
Essentially, you've lost the sense of where you're supposed to go next, and
that's right.
I mean, that's the goal.
So you forget about the present. You forget about where
you're in the immediate.
Yeah.
And that's what I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
I think that is the magic of a place. I mean, the sense of illusion.
You know, in today's sociological time, we live in technology in the future. We need
yes.
to stop living in what's next.
That's right.
Yes.
So how do we create spaces in the immediate? I love that.
Yeah.
You live the present.
You live in the present. I think it goes back to what we've been talking a little earlier, that you have to create something that has a sense of wonder.
But I think
that's
you also
stop you and pause.
Maybe you do manipulate people a little bit to be curious, so that they wander into some space and that they were not expecting that they would wander into.
And that's what we do in winemaking
yes.
all the time.
Yeah.
Like the wine we're just having.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Well,
it is.
And exactly. So James, you're one wine behind. Which is typically you two wines ahead.
It's the camera.
It's the camera.
Well, he's the professor, you know. A lot of his students can see
him. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. They already know I'm a lush. It's okay.
But this is true. You want to take people to places. You know, it's interesting when we do our session of design, you start with a story, with the moment of where people stay and sit and reflect. Mm-hmm. And I do the same with wine. I think it's all about storytelling.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of fun.
And isn't even, you know, when you think about the label, that's kind of the sign of the front door or the road to enter in.
Talking about the Champs-Élysées, let's share a secret. I know our friends one seed before a month.
Yeah.
But we have a preview of the secrets. I think you should explain the new magical, as we're finishing on Raymond, of
yes,
course.
Yes, yes.
You've designed Buena Vista with us, which yeah. is a miracle, and obviously a tribute to the history of the United States.
Absolutely.
You know, first literally, wine in the showcase. Absolutely. Right? Of
yeah. How do you... And that was such a fantastic project in its storytelling, because to create a space that then will generate excitement and pull more and more people into it, and through that pulling the people, then learning about the history of California. Most people do not understand, and every time I tell the story of Buena Vista, everybody wants to know more. They want That's to understand right. The whole, you know, that it was at the birth of California, this crazy count, the whole wine industry, and literally that, you know, when you tell people...
And the landscaping.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And that you brought back into all the native plants, all the native trees.
Yes, and what was grown at the time, and then... Even the counts bringing back all those different varieties from Europe, and the sense of saving the wine of Europe.
Everybody,
I mean,
needs
everybody
to
needs
come.
To understand that, and you get to see that
so,
language.
So
give a preview,
about
now.
Raymond.
Raymond,
I mean,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's our last
well, Raymond,
moment.
Yeah.
Everybody's on the edge.
Yes,
we are building the road that yeah. leads to the epicenter of the world, to the absolute embryonic beginning of wine in America, Raymond Vineyards in Santa Elena. Maybe we're not far away from it today.
No.
Tell us about this magic of the entrance, the alignment.
The alignment,
and
yes.
And what we've designed.
I think what it is, what's so magical, I think, about this project and the notion that it's even beyond just the terroir, it's in the sky. Mm. And so the sky is the inspiration and the energy flow that moves through the valley, colliding together to create an experience that is experienced as you move through it, but you're feeling it at the same time. The notion of tying the great history of French landscape making and astrology, the notion of Leo, which is the inspiration, the constellation that is... influence the alignment of Raymond as you move through, and then the importance of that, how that relates to some of the, not only geomancy, but even so the Steiner approach to things.
Yes.
But this is taking it to another level. This is allowing all the worlds of Raymond and JCB to work together, to flow in a dynamic kind of way that is going to reintroduce you to an amazing institution, to a wine and where it's come from, but it's future at the same time. Because what we are trying to do is to do something of the moment.
That's it.
That it's now.
That's right.
And all the little secret areas, things that we can't talk about right now, because you have to come
it's
here and
secret.
Visit.
Yeah.
But those kinds of little hidden gems, that it isn't until you've come here a couple of times that you start to pick up those cues. And maybe, if you're lucky, you get let in to these secret areas. But the big thing is that even talking about stories of the phases of the moon, in some ways there's a...
Like the roundabout.
The roundabout.
Really is, represents the 13 cycles.
That's exactly right. And then how the layer of the footprint of the constellation meets the moon, and then the cycles of the moon are subtly inscribed into the stone entrance feature. So immediately you know that there's a cycle that is you're about to enter.
Can we even say, and I was thinking a lot about this, because I think we sometimes don't spend enough time researching the meaning of why we are attracted to certain places we go in certain directions.
Yeah.
We look at certain angles. Paris is the prime example. Paris is based on a secret code.
Mm-hmm.
Washington, D.C.
Same
is its
thing,
inspiration
yeah.
to Paris. And what we've done, which is so exciting, is linking the telluric
yep.
to the cosmic. Do you actually feel people will be somehow drawn to it just by the pure, you know,
absolutely.
Energy within themselves to come here?
I think so. I think there's the visual cues, not only of the lay of trees and the forms and the sequencing. I think the energy that's flowing, especially off the significant oak trees that dot this landscape that we functioned in, really did inform how we engaged with that. And so it's that existing landscape, is the vineyard landscape, and then there's the landscape of the entrance, or the you know, what we're all been working together so carefully about.
Yes.
Come together to create this sort of mythical kind of place. And I do think that it's so different that people are going to wonder what it is. It goes back to the foundation of what I think we like to do.
Which I think is so important, and we designed together for the purpose of having people reflect.
Yeah.
And I will never forget at Buena Vista when we designed around the vortex a few key elements.
Yeah.
And we said to ourselves, people will stop here and will look, and time will stop.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it is exactly our intention is today transcribed into reality. And I love that, so I cannot wait to see the Leo astrological print imprinted within the matrix of what we've done and see how people react.
But so much of what we do, you know, we have big imaginations and we dream and so forth. But so much of it is actually, and it's not just because you've given me a bunch of wine, but so much of it is about our clients taking us somewhere else that we wouldn't have expected to go. And it's in all of our projects. It's not just with you, although with you it's
the best ride ever.
Well, because we always have wine.
Yeah. I know, well, exactly.
But we wouldn't have that kind of stimulation to do something that we wouldn't. You know, people live in different ways, or they experience their gardens in different ways. And you know, even when we do public projects, so many times we've designed benches that people use actually as selfie stands as opposed to benches. But we didn't know, and it's okay. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a success. It's not a failure.
Congratulations for that. Now, would you like to share, as we're drinking our Raymond Napa Valley Cabernet?
Yes.
One of the iconic wines that will lead everybody to Raymond, thanks to you and this great road. Is there a message each of you want to send to all our listeners, all our friends who are with us, as a suggestion, an advice, anything you want to say that would lead them to think tonight further about what they do, who they are, and allow them to just think differently? And I know we almost had a bottle each.
So I know,
You're ahead of me.
Exactly.
But everybody's drinking tonight, hopefully.
No, exactly.
Yes.
It's happy hour, after all.
It's happy hour.
I think what I would challenge, I would think to look around where you are at the moment and look around in the house or whatever it is and to rethink it. Like, is it interesting? Do you really want to be there? What challenge everything?
Is it telling your story?
Is it telling your story or who you are? Do you have a voice?
That's right.
I mean, the big thing is the allowing people to have a voice and not be afraid to give their voice. It's okay. It's okay if you like pink polka dots and you want to do your whole house in pink polka dots. It's okay. Yeah. You know, it's not you have to liberate yourself.
Yes.
You have to liberate yourself, and maybe being Californians and being on the edge of the Wild West, it's a little easier for us, but no matter where you are in the world or whatever you're doing, you should challenge the environment you're in, both built and unbuilt.
That's well said. That's a great, great advice, and I'm sure everybody, after watching us, will go in their gardens and patio and terrace and say, I need to rethink this. But it's very true. It needs to be who we are. Yeah. It needs to be the expression of who we are, who we want to be, or what we want to say as a message.
Absolutely.
What about you, Roderick?
Well, my advice is to get an electric bike, because I got one recently. And the possibilities of exploring the cities with an electric bike is incredible.
So you use your bike in San Francisco?
Well, I'm using it in Napa, all over Napa.
Oh, great.
I'm going to bike up to Oakville tomorrow or the next day.
Fantastic.
With my little electric bike. It's changed.
I'm going to see you at the Oakville grocery store.
Well, you know,
pizza.
I mean, yeah.
It's actually...
You're going to get my groceries.
Well, and I say that kind of as a joke, but somewhat sincerely, it actually is a great pace to kind of explore and observe things. But you know, I'm not a road bike person, so it's been transformative to me.
But for people to look, and for people to take
look.
Time to look.
Exactly.
I agree with you. You walk a city, you jog
you
a
walk
city.
A exactly.
Or you bike a city. It's very different than if you
That's
jump
right.
into a taxi, or a car.
That's right.
Well, dear friends, you've been amazing.
Yeah.
You've been amazing friends all those years.
No.
I have so much admiration for what you do, for how you think.
Likewise.
And how you rethink.
Yeah.
And I think it's so important for all of us through this amazing discussion.
Yeah.
I mean, we always have those discussions for hours. So
yeah.
We start with wine, we finish with a case of wine, typically.
Yes.
Yeah, at least.
At least. But I want to congratulate you for having done what you've done. You know, from Harvard to being professors to starting a business to asserting your own friendship, partnership, love of each other, and to building something amazing and a new vision for people to look at the world in a very different way. And I think our big takeaway tonight, as you said, is to go outside of our house and to look at the windows if we don't are so lucky to have a garden or a terrace. And to rethink what we want to rethink. And you said it, using nature, using what we see and what we don't see, to allow what we don't see to come up.
That's right.
And to let it be.
Let it be.
Let it be. So to the Beatles.
Cheers.
Yes.
I guess so.
Yes.
To friendship and to the road.
And to you.
Leading to Rome. Rome is the new Raymond and Raymond is the new Rome.
That's right. Come visit.